We've watched for years now as afflictions that used to be rare grow in number in humans. There are more people with autism, more people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We're generally heavier, like 30 pounds heavier than a couple of generations ago. What's going on? Our guest this hour says a lot of issues can be traced to hormone-disrupting chemicals. What he says they do to us is the title of his book. Sicker, Fatter, Poorer is the book by Dr. Leonardo Trasande, who's both an MD and an MPP with a Master of Public Policy degree. He is a professor and the director of the Environmental Pediatrics Division of the Medical School at NYU in New York, and he teaches public health at NYU as well. Leo Trasande, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to get a little of your personal story in here. You went for the MPP, it sounds like, after realizing some limits to what you could do with the MD training. Like what?
Well, I applied to medical school during the debate around the Clinton health care plan. This is well before President Obama pushed forward his own health care reform a few years later. And it was during the course of interviews for medical school that I was asked for my opinion, and it got to a point where I could have given the usual stock response, but I at one point asked, so I don't really know what the best answer is, and I don't know what the plan will look like at the end. What will I learn in medical school about health policy, its impact on the care we give? And that answer didn't go so well, actually, in the end. I don't know if I got into that particular medical school, but it got me thinking about the need for more training and perspective on this, and that's why I decided to take a year between my third and fourth year of medical school to get the master's degree.
So your dedication in Sicker, Fatter, Poorer begins with Rachel Carson, the famous author of Silent Spring, published in the early 60s. Have the hormone-disrupting chemicals you write about come into use since her time?
They've increased. We today experience a reality where 1,000 to 3,000 new chemicals are introduced into the environment as new chemicals each year, starting on a baseline of about 60,000 as recently, back in the 60s, that is, when Rachel Carson wrote her book. And that occurs in a framework of partial, if limited, information about what these chemicals do to the human body, let alone do to hormones in particular. So the scope and breadth of exposures has increased since Rachel wrote that book so presciently and long ago.
I'm sure the obvious answer from or question from people when they hear the first part of this discussion is, well, are you blaming too much on endocrine-disrupting chemicals? I mean, are there other potential causes here?
So let's take an example with obesity. Nothing in the book takes away from the importance of diet and physical activity as key drivers to maintaining a healthy diet and preventing diabetes. But evidence is increasingly accelerating, suggesting that these chemicals can fundamentally reset how our body metabolizes or breaks down food and processes it into the calories and ultimately fat or muscle or other components of the human body. So an example, a prototypical example of an obesogen is a chemical called bisphenol A or BPA. It's gotten a lot of attention in the news because it was used in baby bottles and sippy cups up until about 2008 when FDA chose to ban it. It makes fat cells bigger. It disrupts the function of a protein that protects the heart called adiponectin. And it is actually a synthetic estrogen and therefore can have an impact on body mass because sex hormones are so important for shaping body mass in a sex-specific way.
I want to make sure we pick up on what you said there because we'll be talking about these again later in the show. Obesogens, that's an actual class of stuff.
We now know of about 50, but that represents only a narrow subset of the universe of chemicals that have not been studied, actually, for their potential influences on ultimately the growth of fat in the human body and contribution to diseases that go with obesity.
So, Leo, if you would, tell us about the Endocrine-Disrupting Chemical Disease Burden Working Group. It's a mouthful, EDC Disease Burden Working Group.
So to boil it down a lot more simply, We put together a large group of experts, about 30, from across the world back in 2013 and 2014, when I was asked by the European Union and the Endocrine Society to document what the actual disease burden and costs were to endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And we put together expert panels, and we selected only the chemicals and their effects, for which the evidence was the strongest. And these were scientists who volunteered their time for this project, as I did. We paid for travel, but not much else. And they participated selflessly in phone calls and other activities. And the idea was that they would look at the literature and identify the strength of the evidence and rate the likelihood that this was actually a human health problem for that individual chemical and that individual effect. And what really struck me at the end of that exercise was the staggering amount of disease and cost to society that these chemicals place. So we started in Europe and found that the costs were over 160 billion euros. That matches out to 210 billion U.S. dollars a year. So that's 1.2% of its gross domestic product. And so for me, one reason for writing this book was that as a pediatrician and as a dad, I wondered to myself, well, if Europe is really concerned about this, what's happening at home? What's happening to my kids? And so we did that exercise again for the U.S. and my eyes didn't quite pop out of their sockets, but I felt like they could have, in that the costs were actually higher in the U.S., $340 billion. That's an annual cost insofar as these exposures continue year in and year out, and that's 2.3% of our gross domestic product.
Okay, Sicker, Fatter, Poorer with Leonardo Trasande, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Leo Trasande, who's both a doctor and an MPP. So an MD and an MPP, Master of Public Policy. He is looking at how we handle endocrine disrupting chemicals, or EDCs, in our culture and society. And he finds that the effects on the human body are not really good, to put it mildly. His book is called Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Obviously, when you talk about these things, you encourage some criticism from people who don't feel the way you do. You mention actual outright attacks, and that made me wonder if you've had any contact with Tyrone Hayes at the University of California, Berkeley, who's been our guest in the past, because he's had some real stuff happen to him in trying to talk about endocrine disrupting chemicals too.
Yes, I know of his work. I respect it a lot. The reality here is that we're talking about uncomfortable realities, and that can have consequences for companies that may not be doing the right thing by human health standards. What reassures me, and you might not expect this, but I'm quite an optimist, and we can talk about why later. There are a lot of companies that are doing the right thing and proactively intervening without being embarrassed or identified as having these contaminants in their products. So I see a lot of hope, and we can talk about more about why in a few minutes.
All right, let's talk about the scenario that you open the book with. It's a twinned scenario in the sense that you give us the same playground, but at two different times in history, in 1962, right, Rachel Carson's time, and now. And what do you find differing in the playground and the people on it?
Well, we see what we see in America today. We see increases in impairments of brain development, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and autism. We're seeing obesity and diabetes to a lesser extent, but it's increasing rapidly. We're seeing changes in the timing of puberty. Puberty is now much earlier than it was even a couple of decades ago. And in general, the population is sicker. I'm not putting the entirety of that increase on chemicals in our environment. Clearly, genetics, behaviors, all are important contributors here, but studies have really carefully looked at individual people and have been able to tease out a specific role for these chemicals that are known to mess with the basic signaling of our human body.
Particularly as far as body development goes, I mean, there's a lot of conjecture about hormones used in the food we eat to encourage chickens to grow bigger and faster, for example. I mean, are we considering those along with the chemicals that are used to get rid of pests and things like that?
One of the things that we're doing in this book is really focusing on the strongest science, the most mature information that really suggests cause for concern and action, frankly. And the other element that is in this book, and as much as it can scare people at first thinking about these chemicals, there's a lot of opportunity for safe and simple steps to reduce these exposures and improve your health in the process.
Leo Trasande, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. Here's a call from Julia in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Julia, go ahead. Julia is listening on the radio, which is 10 seconds behind us. Julia, turn your radio down and listen on the phone, and we'll get back to you in just a moment. Leo, what can you tell us about some history here on pesticides? Because I guess I didn't realize how long we've been using these things to get rid of bugs and rats and things like that.
They go back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. What's different since the 1940s is that in the aftermath of the World Wars and the use of synthetic chemicals as nerve agents, there was a recognition that these chemicals could also disrupt brain function in pests. And originally the thought process was that human brains were more resilient and protected from the effects that would occur at lower levels of exposure in various unwanted creatures and critters. But what we realized as science marched along was that at lower levels where there were no conventional effects originally identified, they found subtle disruption of the thyroid hormone, which, as a pediatrician, I've been drilled into me for years, is crucial for brain development. That's why we check newborns' baby blood spots for thyroid function. What we now know is that exposure to thyroid hormone is crucial in pregnancy because the baby until the second trimester doesn't make thyroid hormone on her or his own. And that's a crucial window for brain development. So you can have consequences for cognitive impairments, even autism and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And now studies have identified consistently associations of the organophosphate pesticides in particular, not just with changes in IQ as measured by a psychologist, but with changes in the brain on magnetic resonance imaging.
The actual physical structures of the brain that we're talking about, not just how the brain works.
That's right. And what's uncanny is the lineup of the parts of the brain that are affected with the neuropsychological deficits that are identified. So that fits like a glove in terms of starting to say, well, X might cause Y and raise serious concerns. And the unfortunate reality is one of these organophosphate pesticides, chlorpyrifos, was going to be banned in agricultural use until about a year and a half ago when then EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt decided that it was not going to be banned because it was crucial for agriculture and because the science wasn't there yet for it.
Which gets us into not just the regulatory part of things, but the people who are asking for leniency or understanding or something from the regulators, which are the people who make these products, the pesticides that contain hormone disruptors. And there is often this discussion of economic burden, but it's a burden to whom? Just them?
Well, Well, there's a misleading approach that's been taken for a long time here. The assumption has been that preventing is something that hurts industry, and that's where we have to start. But the reality is that by producing these exposures in the first place, the industry is functionally taxing the people who are affected, who don't buy or sell the chemical in the first place. So when the pesticide exposure during pregnancy damages the brain of a developing child, and that child goes on to suffer consequences, that's not a person who's a farmer. That's not a person who made the agricultural pesticide in the first place. And that cost to society isn't felt by the producer of the pesticide in the first place. So this goes back to basic principles of economics first described by Adam Smith. So Adam Smith, I like to say, would be rolling over in his grave seeing what we're seeing today. That's actually, that consequence for a child's health is something that creates a market dysfunction, actually. The producer of the pesticide, the company, is overproducing the pesticide compared to the amount that is optimal from the perspective of the society. So by regulating or stopping use of that pesticide in the first place, you're actually undoing an economic damage that's already occurred. And you're righting the ship, if you will. Most of the time we talk about this from the perspective of simply the negative effects of industry, but actually there are huge benefits to society of doing the right thing, which probably should have been done in the first place, but we're in the here and the now. And that speaks to the real trade-offs here. It's not just simply industry suffering the consequences of regulation. There are benefits to human health and the economy that occur.
I'm struck by, though, in the history section of the book, the fact that we always knew from way, way back, thousands of years ago, that the stuff we were using was poison, but we figured it was poison at low enough levels to not harm us. But in some cases, we're finding out it really doesn't matter. You can't get the dose low enough.
Right. There's a scientist from the 1500s who went by the name of Paracelsus, who made this notion that the dose makes the poison. And we've lived with that for 500 years. And the reality is that science, especially over the past 20 years, has made us take a deep breath and realize that that notion doesn't quite hold up for everything. I'm not saying it doesn't hold up for anything, but there are now dozens of chemicals and hundreds of scientific studies that show these low-level effects that occur. And these low-level effects don't make sense to people who were trained under this Paracelsus notion, but that's the real human health reality that we're facing. So some of the tension we're talking about in this book is really about shifting a paradigm in the way we think about these exposures and whether they cause disease or not.
Leo Trasande, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's both an MD and an MPP, Master of Public Policy. He is a professor at New York University's Medical School and the director of the Environmental Pediatrics Division of the Medical School. He's written a book called Sicker, Fatter, Poorer: The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. This is a discussion you're more than welcome to join. 800-838-3760 gets you here by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's try again with Julia in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I am Julia Seiler, and I'm a local listener to Jefferson Exchange, and I live here in Iceland. I have followed Dr. Trasan's work at New York University, and I congratulate him to the publication of his recent book. Mm-hmm. I just wanted you to know that I recently published a book about hormonal disrupting chemicals in life, especially in home. I call these chemicals the enemy. Hence the title of my book, living with the enemy. The book is available locally here in Iceland and Medford in Bloomsbury Books, and as well as through Amazon. My credit sales for grading this book include being a university professor and teaching organic chemistry and toxicology for over 3 years.
Okay, I'm gonna pause you there, Julia, because it is Julia, I guess. I'm sorry. So just to get people to understand, you got your own book you're talking about here, which is Living with the Enemy. I see your Facebook page, and you've got the endocrine disrupting chemicals listed right up top. So you have company out there, Leo. And I just wonder though, because this drumbeat's been going on for a while. I mean, are you getting much response to your work and the work of the people who've come before you, who have been talking about what's up with endocrine disrupting chemicals?
Well, let's talk about what's changed here over the past couple of decades, especially the past 10 years even. The reality is that the science has stepped from the thinking that this was just happening in lab animals and tissues to the direct palpable impact that we see in studies of people. And that's really what grounds me in this book and what I would argue is the newest stories to tell here. As a pediatrician, I still see patients. I actually, just before doing this interview, came from Bellevue Hospital, where I work at the flagship hospital for the New York City Public Hospital System. And the reality is that there are patient stories each day that I see of effects that may or may not be due to endocrine disrupting chemicals. In some cases, there probably are. In some cases, they're probably not. And that's one of the difficulties here. We can't pinpoint every patient with regard to what the origin of their disease is. But it's those patient stories that I tell in this book. And that really speaks to what drove me into this field in the first place. And what drives me in my research each day is it's that human impact. And I've been privileged to work with people who've been experiencing these concerns and diseases now for nearly two decades. And that's a privilege that I warmly embrace, and that's what really motivated me to tell their stories here. And that really, I think, lives witness to the numbers and the science that's also described in the book.
Leo, tell us about the Clarity study of BPA, and that is the chemical BPA, not the Bonneville Power Administration. What was the study, and what was the effect of it?
This study is ongoing. It's a study that was originally filled with great hope and intentions. There's been a lot of debate about the effects of bisphenol A in the laboratory. And one of the big questions is why the studies done by industry don't give the same results as the carefully conducted academic studies to date. And scientists literally from the Food and Drug Administration to the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and academics at universities all got together, despite opinion, grudges, what have you, and they decided to follow a common protocol and really try to pull the data apart in a way that was consistent and see if they can get to yes about the scientific understanding. Unfortunately, very recently, the results of one part of those studies, the ones done by the Food and Drug Administration, were published ahead of the academic work on this field. But what's interesting are really two things. The study findings from the Food and Drug Administration were used to suggest that BPA is still safe. But what's striking here, and there are always shades of gray in science, is that the FDA's own findings suggest low-level effects, like the ones the academics are finding in the first place that got us here, in the range that humans are exposed to each day. And yet the messaging here has gone a little awkward in that a study that was meant to be a collaborative, cooperative activity has been used to represent one side of a debate that well-minded people were getting together to figure out. The irony there is that this effort actually supports what the academics have been saying all along, that there are low-level effects of BPA and other bisphenol exposures. And the real concern here, too, is that BPA is now getting replaced with bisphenol S, bisphenol F, BPP, BPZ. And I know the acronyms don't make a lot of sense to the regular viewer, but what I'm communicating is, in part, is that the acronym speaks to a structural similarity. When you look at the chemical structures, these chemicals are not so different than bisphenol A itself. And that carries over to the laboratory. Studies have found that BPS, for example, a replacement of BPA, is as estrogenic, as toxic to embryos, and even more persistent in the environment.
All right, so it didn't matter which BP you get, but BPA or BPS, you're going to get some effect of it. Leo Trasande, our guest, his book is Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, and we'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about hormones and their importance in making our bodies work correctly and grow correctly, and the fact that there are many chemicals out there that can make our hormones do things they're not supposed to do or be there in distributions they're not supposed to have. And this is covered at length in a book by Dr. Leo Trasande, MD and MPP. His book is called Sicker, Fatter, Poorer: The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. You can join the discussion here on The Exchange. Many questions and comments, no doubt. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Before we move off of BPA, we have an email here from Dean, no town given, who says, please ask your guest about BPA on receipts. Those thermal printers use the plastic to create the darkening. BPA levels are higher in people who handle these regularly. The backside is safer to touch as the chemical is only sprayed on one side. Dean, thanks for the email. And Leo, he's right about that, isn't he?
That he is. There's a great video that's gone viral focuses on keeping BPA out of receipts. I think it's bpa-free.me, and it puts a good sense of humor into it. The reality here is that not only BPA, but even BPS and other bisphenols are being used in these thermal paper receipts lining, and we absorb it onto our skin and ultimately into our bodies, and that synthetic estrogen can have impacts. That's why it's a good idea to say no thank you to those receipts and ask for the electronic receipt.
Wow. I keep the receipts because I like to do the checkbook and paper now, but it's weird. It's, you know, it's like this, do you want a receipt? Oh my God, no. And it will be the response from some people now. That's amazing. Here's a call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, a couple books that have been important to me along these lines is Roger J. Williams' book, Biochemical Individuality, and Robert Lustig's book, The Hacking of the American Mind. And the question I have is, what does the guest have to say about glyphosate, otherwise known as Roundup, which is very pervasive in the environment now?
All right. Thanks for that, Carter. Appreciate you. A lot of concern about glyphosate or glyphosate, whichever way you pronounce it. What do you say about that, Leo? Has that come into your work?
Here's the simple answer, is that eating organic is a guaranteed way to avoid glyphosate exposure in particular foods, because by definition, glyphosate's not allowed. Now, as a doctor and scientist, I believe in genetics. I don't think genetic engineering is an ill by itself, but the reality is there are some serious concerns that have been raised about glyphosate, including the development of cancers in particular. We've got a lot of scientific homework to do. The evidence for effects of glyphosate is not the same as the chemicals I focus on in the book. But the good news here is there are other benefits associated with eating organic, because it's a direct way to lower your pesticide level. in your urine, and we already talked about the effects that pesticides can have on the developing brains of kids.
What is body burden testing, and what did Anderson Cooper learn from it, and you along with him?
Well, that was a unique opportunity. Is when we were on the cutting edge of being able to measure low levels of chemicals in the human body, and Anderson approached us to have himself tested for a suite of chemicals, about 200 or so. We found about 100 detectable in his body, including DDT, a pesticide that's still used to this day to combat malaria in certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Anderson thought his exposure might be related to travel there as part of his career. What was also striking was how high his levels were compared to the rest of the population at the time to certain phthalates, plasticizing chemicals that are also used in cosmetics, lotions, fragrances, and as well as food packaging. And he had levels way above the 95th percentile of the U.S. population. And those are still low levels, but levels that are associated with effects on things like testosterone, the male sex hormone, even sperm count and function, speaking to links to infertility. As the science has gone on, the concerns are also there for not just impacts on things like fertility, but even the heart, as low T is a major risk factor, or at least a marker of cardiovascular risk.
So is there a genetic component to endocrine disruptor exposure? I mean, if you get exposed, will you carry that to your kids, and will it go even beyond that generation?
Well, that's what's so striking about these chemicals, is that even if you're not exposed the next generation down, there are changes, not in the genetic code, but in the markers that are left on the genetic code that signal the replication system of our human body, the gene replication system, to turn up or turn off certain genes. And those markers get passed from one generation to the other and even beyond. There are studies in the laboratory that have found that chemicals like BPA can cause these epigenetic changes that get passed down to the great-grandchildren of the initially exposed population, even if and despite the fact that all the other generations aren't exposed at the same level.
I want to ask about some specific effects that you note in the book. Autism, for example, comes onto the list of maladies that you're suggesting are caused by endocrine disruptors. Which hormone is affected, and by which chemical, do you think?
The strongest evidence here is for thyroid hormone, because thyroid hormone is so crucial as a growth stimulus for certain parts of the brain in a characteristic way. But sex hormones are also potentially important. We know that there is a sex predisposition to autism, where boys, the rates are now, the most recent rates, 4% among boys in the United States, which is quite frightening, compared to 1% for girls. So there may be a sex hormone role as well.
And you mentioned fertility a moment ago. I mean, are we actually seeing a loss in fertility in portions of the population?
Well, there's strongest evidence for decreases in sperm count. That's been measured super carefully now, with multiple studies over a 70-year span showing especially decreases over the past 20 to 30 years in a stepwise manner, suggesting something that's not genetic that's explaining it. Now, what we know from specific individuals are that levels of the plasticizers, phthalates, are associated with these decreases in sperm count. And actually, studies have followed couples trying to conceive and found delays in the time to conception in relationship to phthalate exposure in the male partner, supporting this concern.
So we get once again to the discussion of economics, and just pure dollars and cents economics, and also productivity kinds of concerns, where you have the people who make endocrine disrupting chemicals saying, well, your stuff would cost more if we didn't use this. That's one. And the other one you hear is, hey, we need to do these things, particularly in farming, because we got to feed 7 billion people and soon to be 8 billion people.
Right. And and that's just misleading in as a general statement. Now, I wouldn't disagree in specific examples, but let's use one, bisphenol A. Still using aluminum cans under the guise that we need it to prevent corrosion, but there's a natural alternative called oleoresin, among others, that may be free of health effects. So let's assume that we can substitute it out with a chemical or naturally derived material that's free of effects. We did a study showing that if you do that and decrease BPA levels, you, in some scenarios, can get economic benefits that are greater than the cost. And that's just looking at two disease outcomes, childhood obesity as well as adult cardiovascular disease. And even under the more conservative estimates, it's nearly an equal trade-off. So this notion that there aren't rewards to society for doing the right thing is really misleading. And we're starting to see it in the corporate world as well. You're seeing companies doing the right thing and documenting what's in their products in a transparent way. And consumers are picking those out. And you can see it with organic, for example. There's been double-digit gains in organic agriculture over the past decade. And you're not seeing in non-organic food anything more than a 1% change in use or purchase. And that speaks to the growing trend. And you're starting to see the profit become so lucrative that the price margins are getting narrower. So the big box stores that are out there, you're starting to see organic foods show up. So the old argument that this is just a 1%er kind of thing to do, just don't wash out anymore. The reality is that all of us can, for most exposures, eliminate those of concern without having it hit our wallet or pocketbook.
All right, so we can influence the people who make the stuff, certainly. Beyond that, though, or even before that, I suppose, you can make your own lifestyle choices and changes. I mean, how profound would the changes have to be to more or less eliminate endocrine-disrupting chemicals from your life?
You can do a lot through some basic, safe, and simple steps that don't have to hit your pocketbook. Avoiding canned food is a great way to avoid BPA exposure besides those thermal paper receipts we talked about. Eating organic, especially for the fruits and vegetables where you eat the outer layer, there's a so-called dirty dozen that's high priority. Simply looking at the recycling number on the bottom of plastic bottles, 3, 6, and 7 are the ones to avoid. There's this notion that microwave-safe plastic exists, but that's really at a macroscopic or large-scale level. At a subtle microscopic level, you see leaching of the plastic chemicals into food if you microwave plastics. And the same is true for machine dishwashing plastics with hot temperatures or harsh chemicals. In addition, if they're obviously etched or scratched, it's time to throw them away. And for the brominated flame retardant, simply recirculating the air is a good way to get rid of the persistent organic pollutant dust that accumulate in homes. And now California changed its law to no longer require flame retardants be put in, and the label now declares whether a new piece of furniture you're buying has the flame retardants or not.
You mentioned turning over the plastic and looking for 3s, 6s, and 7s. Don't use those. Are those the ones that contain BPA or something?
3 is for phthalates, mm-hmm. which we talked about are antagonists to the male sex hormone, as well as metabolic disruptors. 6 are styrene, a known carcinogen, and 7 is a catch-all category. I apologize that it includes some plant-based, but the reality is that it still includes bisphenols, and those bisphenols are those estrogens I talked about that also make fat cells bigger.
So you mentioned at the outset, Leo, that you are an optimist, that that you think that we can get past this. But, I mean, what's it going to take beyond changing personal behaviors? I mean, is there enough of a movement afoot, you think, to convince the people who make and use endocrine disruptors that they could change their ways as well?
So look at the BPA-free movement. That was based on a modest amount of science, and it really came from the consumers going to the companies saying, get this out of the baby bottles and sippy cups. And literally those companies ran to FDA insisting on a ban because they had done the right thing and gotten it out of their products. recently, we've seen two major supermarket chains take the Teflon-like compounds we haven't talked about. They're thyroid disruptors. They're perfluoroalkyl acids that are in the linings of, for nonstick purposes, of certain food packaging materials. And these two major supermarket chains, based on a study with five data points, simply took all their supply of these food packaging products and simply set them aside and went to the companies and said, you have to replace this in the products we sell. So similarly, if an employer or a school system or a subway system or bus system really steps up and says, we don't want X in our products, that is even more of a momentum changer than what individuals can do with their wallets and pocketbooks. And look how far we've gotten with individually driven behavior such as the BPA-free movement.
All right, a lot of ground covered so far, and there's a lot more covered in the book. It is called Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. Brand spanking new, just out for a week now, available any place you buy books. Leo Trasande is the author of the book, an MD and a Master of Public Policy at NYU in New York. Leo, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure. It was great being with you.